You are listening to the podcast When Life Gives You Lemons, presented by me, Emma Levy. Having worked with elite athletes for most of my career, it's always intrigued me that a significant number of individuals have encountered some form of adversity earlier in their lifetime. My fascination into this grew when I had my own brush with adversity when I was diagnosed with breast cancer in May 2020 in the midst of the global pandemic at the age of only 36. During this period, I questioned whether it was my positive mindset or maybe something deeper, which enabled me to come back and to train and compete for a triathlon just 1 month following completion of all active treatment. The goal of this podcast is to explore this concept further by meeting a variety of high-performing individuals who have been through adversity but who have come back stronger. Today, I'm welcoming Tom Daly to the podcast. Tom almost needs no introduction. He is the most successful British diver ever, winning 4 Olympic medals throughout the course of his career, finally winning that elusive gold in Tokyo in 2021. He started diving at the age of 7, and by age 14 was the youngest competitor at the 2008 Olympics. Alongside Tom's successes, it hasn't always been smooth sailing, and he has faced numerous adversities throughout his life, all of which he has had to navigate whilst in the public eye. He faced bullying at school, he struggled with his sexuality, and then tragically, when Tom was just 17 years old, his father died tragically from a brain tumour. Despite all of these challenges, outside of the pool, Tom has achieved national treasure status. He is a TV personality, has his own podcast, Made With Love, is famous for his knitting, which apparently was responsible for a surge in popularity of the hobby. He is a powerful LGBTQ plus advocate, fashion icon, husband and father of 2. Thank you, Tom, for coming to chat with us today on When Life Gives You Lemons. It's quite funny, actually, because when I started this podcast, I used to explain to family and friends the premise of the podcast. You know, I'm going to interview these high-performing individuals who have been through adversity, but then come back and achieved amazing things. And I used to say, you know, a great example is someone like Tom Daly. So to be sat here with you today is brilliant.
I know we've been getting this in the diary has been tough, but we got it. And also, because I love the premise of When Life Gives You Lemons. And I think the one thing that stuck with me when I hear that phrase, when life gives you lemon, you know, people say make lemonade out of it. Yeah. But there's also not just lemonade you can make. There's all kinds of different things that you can do with lemons. And I think that's where people can open their mind when something happens to you, that it doesn't just, maybe your path gets changed. Maybe there's something else out there as well.
Yeah. And Tom, you have so much going on, both in diving and outside diving. And throughout your career, you've always been able to bring it and to perform and to really exceed when it counts. Do you have an insight into how you do that?
Experience, I guess, helps. But for me, I think as I've gotten older, a sense of perspective. I think every day, we us as humans lose perspective on, one, what matters most, and two, the perspective of how big we create our problems in our life. And sometimes just taking a step back, being grateful for what you have, and knowing that whatever this competition, whatever this job interview, whatever this high-stakes situation may be it exams, whatever it is, to take a step back, be grateful for what you do have. Because I find that whenever you cannot feel anxious and grateful at the same time. So if you're feeling grateful, it's very hard to feel anxious. So sometimes taking that step back and having the perspective of knowing what you are grateful for in your life at that moment allows you to kind of strip back that anxiety, strip back the pressure and the worries, and just perform.
Yeah. And so if we're talking about gratitude, do you do anything formal? Do you keep a gratitude journal or anything, or is it just in your mind?
It's mainly just in my mind. I used to do a gratitude journal and sit down and do 10 minutes of mindfulness every single day. And then I became a parent. And then, you know, sitting down for 10 minutes at the same time every morning is not always possible. What I like to do is consider mindfulness a way of going to the mind bank. You have your mind bank, and the nice thing about your mind bank when you're doing your mindfulness, you can take out all of this mind cash and it never runs out. You can always go back to that place, that mindfulness, those breathing techniques, and just draw from it whenever you need it. You just have to create the space and the time for you, because we're always so busy running around doing everything, and we've got to do this. Oh, I don't have time to sit down and close my eyes for 10 minutes to breathe. But actually doing that makes you so much more productive on the other side of it, and allows you to see things from a different perspective, allows you to be way more efficient. So that's where knitting kind of came into it, because for me, knitting was my way of sitting down and zoning everything else out.
Yeah, I always say when people say to me, I don't have time, because obviously as a physio, someone will say, oh, I don't have time to do those exercises. And I always say, well, you do have time. You just need to prioritize that time.
Exactly.
And so I suppose things like mindfulness, if you could just set those 10 minutes, even when you're brushing your teeth or anything, you could just use that moment, couldn't you, for that mindfulness?
Exactly. And you know, you by the time you sit down and do have those 10 minutes, when I first started doing it, I was very much thinking, when I sat down there, I was always like, what am I going to do next? How am I going to now get to the next thing? And I couldn't shut off in those 10 minutes. And I really had to train myself to sit there for those 10 minutes and be very disciplined about the fact that those 10 minutes are going to be those 10 minutes. So whether you sit there and think about what you're doing next or you manage to come back to the present, it's not going to change anything. So just being there and being as present as possible was something that I found extremely difficult to do at the start. But with a bit of perseverance, you'll get there.
Can we talk about your career, Tom? Very early on, it was touched by tragedy when your father died from a brain tumour. And you were only 17 years old.
Yes.
You were in the public eye at the time. It was in the lead up to London 2012. I read that you didn't miss any training.
No.
And you competed at the national championships just 1 week after he died.
Yeah.
Do you think you found the time to grieve?
No, I didn't, is the short answer. I think my way of doing anything is to keep going at all costs and never slow down. And normally it's when something big happens and then I'm actually able to relax and rest, that's when everything hits me. I think lots of people might relate to that in terms of whether it's like you're working up to something in your job, working up to exams. As soon as they're finished, you like either crash, get sick, and you just like your body just is like, okay, it's over. But you know, at that time, it was the year before the Olympics. Everything was heating up with that. I got called back from a competition to say that my dad was really sick and that it was time to go home. And I just remember coming home, seeing my dad in the living room and just being like, oh, my God, this is like real. Because there's always something about your parents that you never think that they actually are going to die. And my dad was so incredibly positive the whole way through. And he never let on about how sick he was. So he'd been sick at that point for 5 years, but had periods of like getting way better and then it going into remission and then coming back. And so we never really knew where we stood. And I just remember really trying to be there as much as possible for my family, because I've all of a sudden felt this responsibility that I was the oldest of three kids that my mum and dad had. So my brother at the time, my brothers were 15 and 12. So my youngest brother, you know, I think hit him the hardest, because he had an extremely close relationship with my dad, because, you know, the youngest kid always does. So I didn't have the time and I didn't feel like I had the space to grieve, because I felt like I had to get back on the diving boards and go and win a medal in London 2012 for my dad. I do think in the weird way the universe and the world works, I do think it was kind of meant to be that I had won a world championship for him to see. I had been to an Olympics earlier than maybe I thought I was going to for him to see. So I do think, you know, everything happens for a reason and it teaches us many lessons. And it's only now, since becoming a parent, that I realize all of the things that my dad taught me. For example, one lesson that always stuck with me, which I found to be like incredibly annoying when he used to say it to me, but I was terrified about going to my first national championships when I was 10 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, young. And I just was like, said to my dad, I was like, I'm scared that I'm going to embarrass myself. I'm going to dive terribly and I'm going to come last and it's going to be like people are going to laugh at me. And he said to me, okay, how many people are in that competition? And I said, well, I think there's 18 people in the competition. And he was like, okay, so if you come last and you come 18th, you are going to be 18th best in the whole country. And I remember thinking, oh, but I don't want to come 18th. But the reality was that he was trying to teach me the power of perspective, the power of being like, you know what, 18th best in the whole country, that there's only 17 people on this island that are better than me at diving. It's pretty cool. And I think once you are able to give yourself that perspective, it allows you to take that pressure off. So I never had any pressure from my dad, never had any pressure from my parents. And I was able just to fly when I was with my parents, and they were just there and they would just sit there in the audience. They didn't try to learn too much about the sport because they just wanted to be there to be parents and to be excited about however I did. And I think that was something that was extremely powerful that I learned from my dad.
Yeah, and I read in your book that your dad used to clap at all your dives, yeah. even when you did really badly.
Regardless, he was always there with a massive giant like Union Jack flag. He was just like always like waving it, and I'd always know exactly where he was sitting. So, but I mean, you know, that flag is missed in the audience now, and I remember he used to get told off every time because it was like such a big flag that it would just block everyone's view. But he felt like he had to do it, even to the point where he would go and stand up at the back so that he didn't interrupt anyone because he wanted me to know where he was.
It's such a powerful lesson as a parent that we can all learn, isn't it? Not to put pressure on your kids as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, as a human being, you put so much pressure on yourself anyway. Mm-hmm. You don't need the external pressure from somebody wanting you to do well. You just have to be there to be their rock, no matter whether they're doing well or they're not. You know, I remember my dad, sometimes I would do a training session and I would like be really like distraught about the fact of like how it went. And without even saying anything, my dad used to take me to go and get a McFlurry. He was like, okay, he just drove home and we'd go through the drive-thru and get a McFlurry. And that was just his way of being like, it's okay. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. We're all good. I know, I can see that you're struggling, but you know, at the end of the day, there's always ice cream. And that was kind of that my mentality throughout was like, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how I compete, I know I can have a cheesecake or I can have like, there's always something, which is why I always plan after a competition, something fun for me to do, something exciting that I'm looking forward to eating, whatever it may be, because that little bit of like happiness on the other side will always be there. So regardless of how the competition goes, you've always got that thing to look forward to.
Yeah. So it sounds like your dad was a massive influence on your diving career. And you did start so young. You started, you know, like we said, you were so young at your first Olympics, age 14. And you learned your dives very young.
Yes.
And something I didn't realise, but again, when reading your book, I realised that when you had a growth spurt, you would kind of lose your confidence in those dives and you'd lose yourself and you'd have sometimes this gripping anxiety. How did you deal with that? How did you find the courage to come through that when you felt like you were going to fail?
Oh, there were so many occasions when it was like that, because when you learn your dives, when you're a certain size, that's one thing. Then all of a sudden, you know, when you go through puberty, nothing grows at the same speed as anything. Like one arm or one leg might grow faster than the other. Then all of a sudden your arms are way longer than you think they're going to be. So then it was like adjusting my body position throughout that was, you know, very difficult. And then there would be periods of time where it would be so out of sorts that I would then like hurt myself, things would go wrong. And then I would have these mental blocks. And at one stage, when I was 12, I didn't go on 10 meter for a whole year because I was so terrified about what might happen. And my coach at the time, Andy Banks, he just was so incredibly calm and collected about the situation. And he was, I think at the time he probably felt like, oh gosh, he was doing so well. And I feel like I was just going with the flow of like pushing him to the point where like he was able to do it all. And I was, and it very like comfortably and well. But we didn't anticipate what would happen when I started growing. So Andy just stripped me right back to basics. He took me all the way back to the beginning and was very slow and very patient and allowing me to learn what my new body again, basically. And I think that that period of time is what changed me from being a diver that was good to a diver that was great, because it allowed me to really focus down on the basics, the spotting, the awareness, the entries, all of those things were developed in that period. And when I started going back up onto 10 meter, I felt far more prepared. I felt more aware. I felt more like I knew my body as a diver. And I think that is something that was, although at the time it was very stressful, but allowing myself to have the space to get back and just being kind to myself. I think that's one of the big lessons that I've learned is we are so hard on ourselves when things go wrong and when things don't go right. So just learning to be kind to yourself or treating yourself how you would treat others.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we treat ourselves so poorly that you put that all that pressure on yourself and all of that worry and anxiety, when actually sometimes just taking a step back and being like, it's okay to have a bad day. In 3 months, in a year, you're going to look back on that day and be like, oh, that was, no, it was just a day.
Yeah,
but when you have a bad
but when you have that
bad day, you feel like your whole world is crumbling down. But just sometimes taking a deep breath and being like, tomorrow's a new day, got a new shot at doing better.
Yeah, it's another really important concept, though, that you talk about is with high performance, sometimes just keeping it simple. You know, we don't have to make things complex, do we? Keeping it simple and you can achieve even better goals. And yeah. I think in life, sometimes we try and just make things way too complex when, like you said, if we just pulled it back and just did the fundamentals.
Yeah, I think you strip it back. Like when things get overwhelming, if you strip it back to basics and then you start adding things in as you go and don't try and like change everything all at once. There are going to be moments in your life where things are going to change all at once and everything's going to feel like it's changed. And you kind of have to embrace that and roll with the punches, roll with the changes, because you can only control what you can control. You can't control the uncontrollables. So being able to ride with those uncontrollables, like it's, I liken life to being in like in the ocean on the beach, like let's say, and those waves are coming tumbling down. If you try and fight against those waves, you've got no chance. You have to allow yourself to go through those waves and let the waves take you. And because the more you fight, the more tired you get, the more, you know, and you don't want to end up being, you know, so exhausted that it just feels like the water's taking you down. You want to be able to roll with them a little bit until it's safe to be able to push to the next thing.
Yeah, what a great analogy. Thank you. So let's go to London 2012.
Yes.
The London 2012 Olympic Games, your home games. You're seen as a real medal hopeful. You know, people like the Daily Mail had identified you as one to watch. Everyone's eyes are on you. But as on top of all that, you're dealing with the grief of losing your dad. How did you cope with that pressure and that expectation coming into London?
I don't know how I would have dealt with it if I hadn't done the Olympics in Beijing. I think Beijing taught me so much that as soon as you see those five rings on the wall or on the bottom of the pool, it changes everything. It changes the way that everybody acts. It changes the way that you feel. Diving did not have more than maybe like 10, 15 people in the audience watching when you used to go to nationals and things like that. And then in London 2012, and one in the Olympics, but there were 18,000 people in that London Aquatic Centre. And it's terrifying. And even on the mall, at the Westfield just outside, there was like pictures of me on the wall with like Jess Ennis and some of the other athletes like that were part of the Adidas campaign then. And I remember just thinking, I've got to do it. I've got to like be able to do it for my family. I've got to be able to do it for, and I remember like spinning, because in the synchro event with Pete, I ended up coming fourth with him, and we were very close to a medal, and we'd won medals all year, and I thought that was going to be the chance to win a medal. When we didn't, it was about trying to like see who else might have won a medal in London 2012, because if we didn't win a medal in that competition, our funding was going to be stripped. And I remember in the prelim, didn't dive too well. I finished 15th and just made it through to the semi-final. So did the Olympic champion that ended up winning. He came 18th. So he nearly Wow. didn't make it. But that's diving. And I remember coming in and being so terrified about at every stage because I wanted to do so well. And I remember sitting in the call room for the final and just thinking, this is the moment that I have been training for. It's the moment that I've worked so hard for. Why am I torturing myself through the whole experience? Because I wanted to do so well. I didn't want to mess it up. I was thinking about, what if I do this? What happens if I mess up a dive? What happens if I don't win a medal? And actually, when you start doing that, like when you start worrying, I feel like worrying is a prayer for bad things to happen. So as soon as you start going down that road and thinking that way, it's what's going to happen. So I just thought, you know what? I drew the picture when I was 9 years old of wanting to be there. I've dreamt about it every single day, my whole life, thinking about what this moment was going to be. I remember walking out and actually was like, you know what? I'm not going to be the person that's just going to stare at the ground and just be like, oh my gosh, this is so terrifying. This is terrifying. I wanted to like look up, soak it in, because there's never going to be an experience where I can dive in front of a home crowd again in an Olympics. It's just not going to happen. I remember looking around and thinking like, wow, this is what I've worked for. This is why I've put in all those hours of training. It's why I've, you know, had the injuries, had the tiredness, had the stress. All of this is for this moment. So I better enjoy it, because 4 years of that work for that moment is, you got to make sure it's worth it.
So you took the moment and you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I had a blast. I mean, first dive, I had to do a re-dive, which I'd never done before in a competition. And I don't think it's ever happened in an Olympic final. But there was flash photography, and I had to... Which, I mean, that led me onto a whole different level of scarred as well when it came to mental block after that situation in London 2012, to the point where I ended up actually having to learn a new twisting dive.
Really?
Off the back of
it. You couldn't go back to that twisting dive?
Yeah, because I was doing it for the year after, and it was just so terrifying for me every time because of that. It was a traumatic experience. That in the end, Jane, my new coach, showed me a YouTube video of somebody doing a circus trick in Cirque du Soleil on a Russian swing, and she was like, I think we can do this. And I was like, what, you mean turning a circus trick into an Olympic dive? And she was like, yeah, we can. And lo and behold, I was the first person to compete that dive on 10 meter, which is...
That's amazing.
Kind of surreal.
And is it now a popular dive? Do other divers use it?
No, people are not crazy enough to do it, because it is... The funny thing is, it's the same degree of difficulty, but it's so incredibly difficult to do. It's just one of those, it's a running dive, it's a forward 3.5 somersaults with one twist. And it's, you run down to the end of the board, you take off, you do 2.5 somersaults, you flick out, do one twist, and then you have to continue doing another somersault and then hit the water. So there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. So in London, you won that bronze medal.
Yes.
And then I think you took a bit of time off after London, didn't you? Because... Did you have a bit of the post-Olympic blues that everyone talks about?
I really struggled after London 2012 because I didn't know what was next. All I thought about my whole diving career since 2005 when it was announced was London 2012. Mm-hmm. And that was my... And I was all of a sudden, I was like, oh, gosh, life's still moving. Like, I'd had this moment where I'd won this medal and was so elated. But then I also couldn't talk to anyone about how I was feeling, because... If I talked to any of the teammates, they were like, well, you won a medal. Like, what are you talking about? Why do you feel lost? Like, you've got everything to go forward for. And I only ended up actually taking, I think it was 8 days, because I was going to the Junior World Championships.
After the Olympics?
Right after the Olympics.
You had 8 days off.
Yeah, 8 days off. And then I was off to Australia for the Junior World Championships, which went well. But then after that, I had this period of like, you know... Once that all slowed down and stopped, I was like, what am I going to do? Where am I going next? Do I really want to dive again? Do I really want to go through another 4 years just to get to the Olympics again and like maybe win a medal, maybe not win a medal? And so I was really lost in what I wanted to do. But I didn't really have anything else to do. I mean, I was still doing my A-levels at the time, but...
Still so young.
Yeah. Really. I was 18.
Yeah.
And then I went to... Andy at the time, I was like, look, Andy, I don't know what to do. I don't know if I really just feel like I have to call it quits. Like, I've put everything into this and I just don't have anything left in me. It was like I burnt out completely. And that was when I took a week off. In theory, like, I'd quit, like, that was it. I was like, I'm out of here. But it just timed out well that I was then going to LA for a the Nickelodeon, I don't know if it was like Kids' Choice or Teen Choice, like something like that. And they had some... like a British section of it where they had me present that section. So I was over there doing the presenting for that. And that was when I met Lance.
Now husband.
Yeah, my now husband. And I genuinely think that without Lance, I would not be diving today. That I would never have found the motivation to go back. Because I know it sounds silly, but when you meet someone and you kind of like, you love at first sight, really. I remember meeting him and thinking, oh no, like I didn't know what he had done and what he had achieved before. So I was like, once I found out that he had like, you know, won an Oscar for a screenplay, I was like, oh gosh, like he's not going to want to be with someone who's not actually dived, like, you know, at the peak of their career. And I felt like I had to like go ahead and like prove, and actually that was a motivation for me to like go back and get back into some kind of diving shape, which I know it sounds really silly and a bit like, why were you wanting to impress somebody else so much? Why did you care what someone else thought? But I did. And if I didn't think that in that moment about Lance, then who knows? Like, maybe I would never have gone back to diving.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I needed that moment of... And I was able to speak to Lance about... achieving something and then what it feels like on the other side of it, like he had won his Oscar and then on the other side of it really struggled to get back into what he wanted to do and in the film space. And I was like, oh my gosh, I finally found someone that understands what it feels like to be at the pinnacle and then all of a sudden be at rock bottom and not knowing what to do or how to get out of it. He had also lost his brother, I had lost my dad, and we were able to connect on so many levels, although we were in two very different fields and didn't necessarily have that much in common. Well, we found out we had a lot more in common than we thought, but it was amazing actually over the years now to feel like I've really found my lifelong teammate. And I think that's the, like, all you could ever ask for in a marriage is being able to find your, like, partner in crime, to be able to, like, really feel like you want to dream something up or you want to do something and you can both figure out a way to make it happen against all odds. Yeah. And I think that's something that's really quite, you know, I feel very lucky to have found that.
And you hadn't come out as gay yet, had you?
No.
And then you came out publicly via a YouTube video.
I did.
And I believe that your management company weren't supportive of that at the time. So how was that for you as a sports person coming out in the public eye?
You know, it was very difficult in the way that I was already struggling with post-Olympic blues, if you like. But like, I've known for a very long time that I was gay, but I wasn't able to really necessarily identify what that was because I didn't necessarily identify as like, you know, it's a spectrum, right? So I didn't necessarily identify as 100% gay. I felt like I could definitely live the rest of my life and be completely fine, but maybe slightly unhappy, like living what people consider a normal, straight, heterosexual lifestyle. But I remember meeting Lance and thinking for the first time that it wasn't just a sexual thing. It was also like I could fall in love with a man. And, you know, that was in March 2013 that we met. And I told my best friend Sophie, was the first person that I told. Everybody needs a Sophie in their life when you want to be able to share something like that. And then I met, well, I got my husband, now husband Lance, to meet my mum. And I just found out this literally the other day, actually, that when my mum, when I was telling my mum about Lance, I mean, like, what do you think of Lance? Like, what do you, like, she thought that I was trying to set her up with her. And I was like, I don't know if my mum even knows that I know, because she told someone that that's what she thought. And anyway. But I was like, oh my gosh, that's quite funny. But yeah, so I told my friends, I told everyone at the, like, people knew from March. And you know that you've got good friends when it actually manages to stay, you know, quiet. And basically what ended up happening, I got asked in an interview about, like, why do you think you've got so many, like, gay followers and people that, and I was like, well, maybe because I'm half naked all the time. And then it was followed up, like, what do you think about the people that think that you're gay? And I was kind of like, you know, it doesn't matter if I am, like, what does it matter anyway? And then, like, the headline was, like, Tom Daley, I'm not gay. Mm-hmm. And that, like, infuriated me because I didn't want to ever be seen to be ashamed or lie about my sexuality. So then it started the, how am I, like, I remember calling the management and being like, we have to correct this. We have to, like, say, like, you have to get them to change it. They were like, well, if you call them up and tell them to change it, you're coming out on, you know, to that paper. And I was like, okay, right, so what are we going to do? And we were like, and I was like, I don't want to make a big deal of it in the way that is going to, on a TV show to talk about it or on a newspaper to talk about it, because, you know, people can twist your words, people can ask follow-up questions. And I just thought, you know what, the way that I've always done it is to speak to my followers through social media. So I was like, I'm just going to record a YouTube video. So I sat in my room and I just started talking to my phone. Like, I was just shot it on my phone, like, in a selfie mode, and just started talking about how I was feeling in that moment. And I was so terrified to post that. I sat on that video for like maybe a week or two, because I was like, I don't know if I can do this. Do I really want to do this? Like, because when you come out, you feel like you're building it up to be this big thing where your life is going to end on the other side of it. And I remember posting the video and feeling this weight lift off my shoulders. And I finally felt like I could be me, and I didn't have to worry about people finding out, because people knew. Yeah. And I didn't have to change the way I was behaving. Like, I used to bring my friend Sophie with me and Lance on dates because I didn't want people to find out. Like, really? I was so terrified about people judging me that I was changing my whole sense of being. And since I came out, I was able to, like, my training improved, my, like, mental health improved, my happiness improved, my productivity improved. I just felt, and I was so incredibly lucky to have a great support system around me, because not everybody has that. Not everybody is completely 100% supported when you come out. So I was very lucky to have that. And it could have been very different. But like I say, I'm grateful to have been able to flourish on the other side of it.
And then that helped you in your preparation for the Rio Games 2016, didn't it?
Yes.
And I think, again, that you had massive expectation to medal there.
Yeah.
And individually, it didn't go how you wanted it to go.
Absolutely. Yes.
And how did you then move forward after those games?
I thought Rio 2016 was going to be my last Olympics. Funny now, looking at that going into this one. But I thought it was going to be my last Olympics. I thought, the age of 22, I felt like I was in my physical peak. I felt like I was in my mental peak. I was like, this is going to be the games where I win an Olympic gold medal. I had won many events in the build-up to it. I did the prelim, Olympic record at the time in the prelim. And I was like, this is going well. The next day, come in for the semi-final and things just go awfully wrong. So wrong that I end up 18th place and I needed to come top 12 to make the final. So I didn't even get a chance to be able to be in contention to even fight for a medal at that point. And I remember just feeling so deflated about, and I honestly think it was one of the worst days of my life. You know, losing my dad was difficult, but when you build something up in your head about what you want it to be and it goes so incredibly wrong, like I remember just completely crumbling and being really so upset. I remember in the mix zone, I said right away, like, this isn't at the end for me. Like, I'm going to go again. I will come back from this.
Yeah.
And I said, I met Lance in the like parking lot or like the car park outside. And he said to me, him being the writer and the filmmaker, was like, Tom, this isn't the end of your story. This, your career doesn't end here. This is just the, you know, this is the middle. Every story has a beginning, middle, and end. And maybe you weren't meant to win an Olympic gold medal here because maybe your future child is meant to see you win an Olympic gold medal. And lo and behold, 4 years later, well, 5 years later in the end, we were able to do it.
Because your journey towards Tokyo was very different because you were now a father.
Yes.
And do you think becoming a father changed your perspective then?
Hugely. Becoming a father changed my perspective. The COVID pandemic changed my perspective. And the fact that the Olympics got delayed, the things that things can change at any moment. Things can be taken away. Things can be moved up, moved around. And you just have to be in the moment. Because as soon as you start living for the future, you're too far ahead. If you start living from your past, you're thinking too far behind. You have to. The only way to truly and authentically live is just to be in the moment. Because, of course, you want to plan for the future and you want to have your goals, but being in the moment allows you to be able to be grateful, to have the perspective on what you need to do that day in order to be able to achieve what you want to achieve. And I think that was what, again, going into those Olympic Games, you can't feel anxious when you're feeling grateful. And like when I was standing on that diving board, it was like, no matter what happens here, I know that I have my husband and kid at home that are going to welcome me back with open arms, regardless of how this competition goes. And I felt very lucky, happy, and I was like, you know what? This diving isn't the only thing that's me. I am so much more than just a diver. Diving isn't going, whether I dive well or not, isn't going to define me as who I am as a person or like how my life is going to go in the future. All I need to do is know that I'm being the best person that I can be, the best dad, the best husband, best friend, all of those things. And once you can realize that you're more than what you do, then what you do becomes fun. Yeah. It becomes exciting. It's not your be-all, end-all. It's not the thing that you think about every single second of the day. And of course, you want to be passionate about what you do, but you can't let that your work or your thing that you do consume every single aspect of your life, because as soon as you do that, you've already lost.
Yeah, I talk about this a lot because it's about finding your values, isn't
yes.
it? And when I was ill, I read the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And it says, he who has a why can bear with almost any how.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that so, it really rings true. You know,
yeah.
And again, you know, not to be defined by just, like you said, to be defined by being a diver. Because if that gets taken away from you, what have you then got?
Exactly. So, yeah. And I think that is a huge struggle for lots of athletes is... all you've done your whole life is perform at the highest level. You get to travel, you get to do all of these things. And all of a sudden when it stops, what do you do? I've been incredibly lucky to have other things outside of diving that I've still been able to do. But for many athletes, it's almost a hindrance to be an athlete until you're older because you have to start again. You have to start where lots of 18-year-olds are starting at the entry level of jobs and build your way up because you haven't had the experience of working. You haven't had the experience of what it's like to be in a 9-to-5 job because you've been an athlete and it's been your life. So it's something that lots of athletes really struggle with. And some athletes are lucky enough to get like internships and be able to like start in a more, in a higher up place. But actually most have to start from scratch.
Yeah. And I don't think necessarily the public know actually what you went through in the final stretch before Tokyo.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that 8 weeks out you had knee surgery.
Yeah.
You had COVID so bad that you were hospitalized.
Yeah.
So all of those challenges, I want to ask you, how did it actually feel when you won that gold Olympic medal?
Gosh, yeah. The whole year in the build up to the Olympics, I broke my hand. I then came back and then I got COVID so badly, like you say, I was hospitalized. I literally couldn't even walk up and down the stairs. I had to be like carried. Like I was so sick. And I remember coming back from that slowly but surely, and then going to the World Cups and the European Championships, and then coming back, I stood up from a meditation and I tore my meniscus, and it like was a bucket handle tear. So then my leg locked. And I couldn't straighten it or bend it. So I found out I had to have surgery 8 weeks before. And I was just thinking, like, everything is being thrown at me going into this competition. And I think that was where it felt, again, I just had to keep everything in perspective. I used everything I possibly could in terms of visualization and being able to really try and do whatever I could, all the things I didn't necessarily have time for when I was training, like the mobility, the stretching, all of those extra bits. And getting to the Olympics, it kind of got to this point where I was like, you know what? I've done what I can. I've done everything in my power to get here. I'm lucky to be here. I'm grateful to be here. I remember when the first event, the women's 3 meters started and they started the parade, I remember just starting crying. And I was like, it's actually happening. It's actually happened, because there was a period of time where we thought it wasn't going to happen. And I remember waking up the morning of our competition with Matty, woke up, and there was something about that day that just felt like it was going to happen. It felt like it was always already written in the stars, like it was going to happen. We were going to win. And I don't know why I felt like that. I just felt like I had this state of flow. It was like going for breakfast. We're going to sit down. And then we sat down and Adam Peaty sat across from us. And he, like, as he went up to go, he was like, right, he was competing that day as well. And he was like, right, okay, let's go win some medals, boys, and I'll see you later. And so we went to the pool and everything was just, like, going along nicely. And the way that we got drawn in the eight teams, we were right before Russia and China, who were our two biggest rivals. So we were able to kind of set the standard and they had to follow. And the whole way through, we were in the lead, and we'd never really been in that position to have the Chinese chase us rather than us chasing the Chinese divers. So I remember going into the last dive knowing that we had to do something pretty special for them not to be able to catch us. And we did the best front 4.5 we've done in competition, but we then had to wait and we had to think, like, okay, what can China catch us? And yes, they could. And I remember seeing them take off and thinking, oh my gosh, they are so in time. And they hit the water and I was like, I remember standing there thinking, they've done it. They've actually gone and beaten us. They've done it. And then I remember looking to the judges, and I won't say which one, but one of the judges was like, looked at me and went, as if to say, like, they haven't done it. And I was like, yeah, but is that a no, as in like, we haven't done it or they haven't done it? And I was like, oh my gosh, like, what's happening? And then I remember saying to Matty, there was like one little scoreboard that was below the big scoreboard. And that comes up like a half a second or a second before, which is why you see me react so quickly before anyone else has, because I saw it. China come up and it said number two, and I turned to Matt and I was like, oh my god, I just jump on him, and I was like, couldn't believe it. And then when Jane joins in to like give me a hug, she like basically bashes me in the face, and I have this like gash on my face you'll see on the podium where I'm bleeding. And I just remember standing on that podium and thinking, wow, like all of the ups, the downs, the 20 years that I had been diving, like I, like we had done it. And it was such a surreal experience to be able to stand on that podium, hear the national anthem, and just be like, you know what, everything that I've ever wanted to achieve in my sport, I've done now.
Yeah.
And it felt like a very poignant time to be able to just leave it at that and be like, right, that was it, that's my diving career, I'm done.
And look at you now, Tom.
And then I'm back. And then like 2 years later I was like, oh, it's only a year to go, maybe I'll give it another shot. So yeah, here we are.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you that. You know, you have achieved one of the top accolades in your sport. And yeah, like you said, you were ready to go. What has now motivated you to return?
My kids. It was actually when we were... So Robbie was born in San Diego and Phoenix was born in Colorado Springs. So Colorado Springs, I didn't know at the time, was the Olympic city in the US. It's where the Olympic Trading Center is. They have the Olympic and Paralympic Museum. And before Phoenix was born, I took Robbie to the museum just to have a little look around. And we got there and instantly they were like, you're an Olympian. Right. OK, right. You got this like badge they put on, and then you walk into the museum and they like clap for you. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Robbie was like, Papa, why are they clapping? And I'm like, oh, because Papa went to the Olympics, remember? And he was like, OK. So then we go through this whole museum, and then at the end they show this very like motivational and like inspirational video. And then the lights come up from this thing after we've been sitting there for 10 minutes, and I am just like bawling, crying, because finishing a sport, there's like, it, you have to grieve for that, like that part of your life, if you like. And I remember sitting there crying and like having watched some of the events recently and like not necessarily seeing the biggest of standards. And I was just like thinking, oh, maybe I should have not stopped. And I remember Lance turning to me and he saw me crying. He was like, oh shit, you're going back, aren't you? And I was just like, I don't know. And then Robbie was like, what's the matter, Papa? And I was like, oh, I think, I don't know, I just feel sad because Papa used to dive in the Olympics. And Robbie was like, but Papa, I want to see you dive in the Olympics. And I was like, oh my God. And I drove home, like on the freeway, like, and I don't know how I didn't get stopped or something. I was like driving at 55 miles an hour, just like staring, like, oh my gosh. Like in silence all the way home. And then I remember Lance pulling me aside and being like, you know, it's okay. You can go give it a try. If you go, you don't have to tell anyone. Go back, see if you like it, see how you feel, and we'll go from there. So when we got to LA, I was like, you know what, I'm going to go and do a couple of sessions. And I was like, you know what, I think I can do this. I think I can. And it's, yeah, now we just got to keep the momentum going.
Yeah, what we do for our kids, hey?
I know, exactly.
Tom, this podcast is, like I said at the beginning, about the concept of trauma to triumph. And we've discussed some of your adversities you've been through. I wanted to ask you how much of your success you attribute to the difficulties that you've been through in your life.
Most of them, because without those downs and without those failures, I know everybody says that you learn from your mistakes, or but there's also things that aren't necessarily a mistake that you've made. There are things that happen that are out of your control that do teach you so many valuable lessons. And I think the one thing that something that traumatic happens or something that is out of your control happens is a sense of perspective. And it allows you to just to be able to let go and just focus on what you can do, because you can only do what you can do. You can only do your best. You can only try as hard as you can. So as soon as you start overthinking that, and as soon as you start to try and control everything in order for you to be able to achieve what you want to achieve, it's too much. You can't carry all of that. You have to try and unburden yourself of nearly everything as much as you possibly can, because someone that is unburdened, someone that is able to kind of just be able to let go of all that pressure, be able to have extreme perspective on what you're doing, is the person that can fly. Every single thing that gets stripped off of you allows you to go higher and higher in what you do. But it takes extreme patience and discipline and a lot of hard work and experience to be able to take off all of those things to allow yourself to go, because often the person that is holding you back the most is yourself. And whether that's mentally, whether it's physically, whether it's something that you could change in your lifestyle, whatever it may be, it's always 99% of the time comes down to ourselves. So I think having a great support system around you is incredibly important, but also just believing in yourself because, you know, the body achieves what the mind believes at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to believe in yourself because if you, you know, I also think of it as in like, if you don't, you know, if you don't try, you never will, but if you try, you might. So you've got to go for it.
Yeah, I fully agree with that mindset. Yeah. And you've got an amazing mindset. And we've talked about some of the tangible strategies that you've used to get there. You know, you've kind of mentioned things like meditation. You've mentioned your knitting. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned mindfulness.
Yeah.
There's so many of these strategies. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you think has been really important for you?
I think also making space for life, making space for time with your friends, your family, because that's just as important. I feel like that is an extreme recovery in itself. You know, being able to take your mind away from what you do every single day and know that there is life outside of what you do. Because when you know that, you are able to start to compartmentalize things and not let other parts of your life bleeding into one another. So for me, I think it's being able to make space for you, make time for you, make time for you to be able to learn something new, learn a new hobby, do something that makes you excited about, like for me with knitting, like when I'm finished training, I know that I'm going to go home, sit on the sofa and knit. I get so excited about that. For some people, it might be reading a book. For some people, it might be listening to a podcast, whatever it might be. But knowing that you have something at the end of the day or throughout the day that you are really looking forward to doing, once you can find that, I think it can be your secret superpower.
Yeah, like creativity is so important, isn't it? Yeah. I remember someone recommending a book about creativity over the lockdown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And before that, I hadn't really ever thought, I thought I'm not a creative person at all. You know, I'm a scientist, I'm a physio.
Yeah.
And then I read that book and then, you know, we had COVID and then I got ill and everything. And I started thinking about my creative side. Yeah. So like you and knitting, my creative side has come out through this podcast.
Yeah.
And what it's given me is unbelievable.
I think everybody is creative in their own way. Even people that think that they're least creative, you have to be creative in order to be able to think outside the box and to solve problems. Because without that creativity, you know, sometimes, of course, logic helps, but then being able to be creative and think outside of the box to solve solutions, like to create, solve problems is, you know, it's important.
Yeah. Final question, Tom.
Yeah.
If you could go back in time to when things were at their toughest,
yes,
what do you wish you could have told yourself?
You know, of course you would say things like, you know, things are going to get better and you're going to come out the other side of it. But at the time, I think, you know, I think back to like when my dad passed away or like when I wasn't after the Rio Olympics, just being able to say to like myself, like, look at all you have. Don't think about the things that are now no longer there. What do you have around you? That, and I think that's the most important thing. Like for me back then was like, you have your mum, your family, your brothers all around you right now. And don't push them away. Don't not talk to them because you don't want to upset them. Sit down and have those conversations and sit down and talk about your dad. Because, you know, at the time we didn't really want to talk. We were very British about it. We were just very much like, oh, yeah, that's sad. And we didn't talk about it. And I think it's only as we've gotten older that we've been able to sit down and have those conversations that I really wish we could have had at the time. But, you know, my brothers were 12 and 15. And my dad was only 40 when he died. So he's extremely young. And, you know, I just think, oh, my gosh, like if I, like I'm only 11 years away from that age, which seems so surreal.
Yeah.
But I wish, I think back at my hardest, I wish I had made myself sit down with my mum and my brothers and really just talk it out, because the power of talking to someone is huge.
Yeah, oh, I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Despite the fact you've been through, you know, these huge amounts of adversities, you have triumphed in all of your chosen fields.
Oh, thank you.
I think you're an absolute role model.
Thank you.
I work in the sport of diving, and I honestly don't think I've ever heard a bad word said about you. I think you bring such positive energy wherever you go. You are a true LGBTQ plus advocate, and I believe that you have inspired a generation.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
If you enjoyed that chat with Tom Daly, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to When Life Gives You Lemons and share it with all of your friends. Thanks.